Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and we're beginning the week with a show about the pandemic and our individual assessments of risk. If you went to a large grocery store over the weekend, you saw risk experiments in real time. You saw some people gloved and masked. You saw others ungloved and unmasked. And you spotted others somewhere in between. And that's not counting the people who still haven't left their homes. Make no mistake, the virus is still highly contagious, and most of us have not been exposed to it. States that have opened, like Arizona and North Carolina, are seeing increases in cases. But as mandates from state and city governments expire, including here in Minnesota on Wednesday, we're each deciding how much risk we can tolerate. Is it worth the risk of hugging a grandchild? Is it worth it to visit a parent in another state? What about going out for a long-awaited restaurant meal? I've been doing a gut check about returning to the gym. How much risk am I willing to undertake to get a workout with some workout friends in? So as our guests join us, I'd like to hear how this is unfolding in your own life and in your own household. Are you wrestling with a sense that the greatest threat has passed and that you can safely let your guard down? How are you calibrating what's okay to do and what isn't? So I'd like to know just what your gut tells you about where we are. And that means, you know, factoring in the numbers, factoring in the warnings, factoring in some of these mandates that are now expiring. And then just what your own sense of, I guess, really your own tolerance for risk feels like. How are you figuring out what's okay to do and what isn't? 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Dr. William Miller is with us. He's an epidemiologist at Ohio State's College of Public Health, and he's with us from Columbus, Ohio. And Dr. Miller, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Ann Bostrom is with us. She's a professor of environmental policy at Evans School of Public Policy and Governance at the University of Washington. And she's with us from Seattle. And Dr. Bostrom, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Dr. Miller, I want to hear from you just real quick on what you make of these cases in some states where I noted Arizona, North Carolina among them, where they relaxed some of these restrictions fairly early, and now they're seeing an increase in cases. Would that have happened anyway because we're seeing more testing, or is there something special to note here?
No, I think the increase in cases is related, at least in part, to the relaxation of restrictions. If you think about it, most of the country has been doing a good job remaining at home for the last couple of months. And we did a great job flattening the curve. But now as you open things up, instead of potentially even seeing a little downward trend, we're seeing either continued flattened curve or increase across many states.
What I notice about that, Dr. Miller, is we don't hear those state leaders saying, as I think they were saying, you know, like in March and April, well, if we see an increase in cases, then we know what to do. You don't hear that. And I wonder if that is more about quarantine fatigue, worries about the economy, kind of saying, well, I think we're all accustomed to this. And now we're going to tolerate it. What do you think the reason is that we don't see more messages of retreating back?
Well, I think the biggest reason, frankly, is the economy. The The economy has clearly taken a big hit. And in any public health crisis, there's always a balance between what you can do for the public's health and the impact on the economy, because a poor economy also has public health consequences. So our leaders nationally have decided, in essence, that it's now important enough to open up the economy that they're willing to take a greater risk on the pandemic side.
Yeah. So, Dr. Bostrom, you study risk and social behavior. How do you assess some of the decisions that are being made now, 4 months into this, and what we're willing to tolerate when it comes to risk, and what we were willing to tolerate in, let's say, March?
Well, a lot has changed since March, as you can tell. The fact that people are now very widely adopting the precautions that their public leaders and public health officials have asked them to take suggests that people are seeing an importance of taking risk precautions and are feeling that they're protecting themselves more than they were before. So some of this increased risk is only happening to those people who are not taking as many precautions, perhaps, or who are in increased exposure circumstances. So the risk distribution is probably not the same as it was originally, and our public health leaders are also making decisions about where they think they can control the risk better.
Yeah, but
here in Washington,
go ahead.
Here in Washington, our public health leaders and the governor have talked about the fact that they may indeed have to close things up again soon. So it's not that the dialogue's not there. It's just not as heard as loudly right now. People have a lot of reasons to want to be out and about.
And here's my other question about this. Are many of us making these risk assessments, whatever we're deciding to do about this, in kind of a logical way, or are we relying more on, as I suggested, kind of an emotional reaction to what this has been like, fatigue, the economic consequences, and does that make sense when we assess our risk?
As you stated, there is a bit of both. When people assess risk, they often use something that's called the affect heuristic, where their emotional responses may be governing their judgments about the balance of risks and the way that they want to tolerate those risks or take actions against those risks. So what we find is that people do the same thing that scientists do to some extent. They think about risk comparisons. They think about what their situation is and what they can do about the risk, and they think about how scary the risk is. And so that's not a formal scientific assessment, but it is still assessing what the hazard is, what the source and pathways of the risk might be, and what the consequences are for those risks and what they can do about it. So the difference is that we are not very good intuitively at assessing the probabilities of any of those, and we often don't know the source and pathways of exposures to, for example, COVID-19 anywhere near as well as the experts.
Yeah. Manny says on Twitter, tolerance about the same, but understanding of what is more or less risky has changed. And yeah, the protests as a reason to tolerate risk have also made a difference. Big difference between going to a bar and witnessing for justice. Same bio risk, different benefit. Yeah, I'm going to ask our guests about some of the things that have been said about tolerating higher risk to go out and protest for a good purpose. So I'd like to hear from you this morning about how you're wrestling with this sense that the greatest risk, the greatest threat from the pandemic is over. We don't know that, but you see businesses, many businesses reopening with the go-ahead here from Governor Walz on Wednesday. This is happening in many states. Do you feel like you can safely let your guard down now? How are you calibrating what's okay and what isn't? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and to Linda in Minneapolis. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Tell me how you're coming to some decisions about this.
Well, I am struggling with a huge decision. I have a daughter who lives in New Hoboken, New Jersey, and she just had a baby. Our previous plan was I was going to go there the month of June to help her. Then with COVID, I said, oh, no, I can't do that. I'm not going to fly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 70, and I have a slightly compromised immune system, otherwise very healthy, but I had had Lyme disease several years ago and was very sick.
Yeah.
So I don't really want to fly, but my daughter is now having a hard time with this new baby. Her husband's been called back to work.
Suddenly,
torn.
Yeah, some of the...
Totally torn.
So, what I hear, Linda, here is some of the factors in the risk assessment have changed. Maybe some of them have become a little more urgent. Dr. Miller, how do you make the right decision given all the different factors and the interests that Linda's trying to balance?
Yeah, sure. I can talk a little bit specifically about flying, but I'll also just give an overview for folks to think about risk generally. So,
okay, good.
I have a little rhyme, time, space, people, place. and that rhyme allows you to think through the risks that you're deciding between. So time is the duration that you will be with people, particularly the duration that you'll be close to them. Space is whether you're able to maintain physical distancing, 6 feet or more. People is, are you mingling with people whose risks you don't know, or are you spending time with people who you know have been cautious and basically have been staying at home also? So essentially, do they have a bubble around them like you've had a bubble around them? And then place simply is outside is far better than inside. And if you're inside, are you in a space that is well ventilated, has, you know, is a more spacious with a lot of air movement? So airplanes, unfortunately, sort of are strikes against them all along that pathway. In an airplane, there is reasonable air exchange and the filters are good, but you're pretty highly exposed to people for at least an hour for most flights. You don't have any control over who's next to you. You don't have any control over what those people do, whether they're talking, whether they're coughing, and that sort of thing. And you also have to think about the risk in the airport. So it's unfortunately a fairly risky activity and one that I generally recommend avoiding. Now, in a circumstance like the caller just had, where it's potentially one flight with a long visit, that makes it a harder decision. Simply because on any single flight, the risk is probably pretty low. But when you take flying in general, the risk is potentially a problem. So
yeah,
it's a very difficult decision.
I mean, it's also, I think Linda told us that her daughter's husband is now called back to work, coming in and out of the house. I think you'd have to factor that into what the household is going to be exposed
Correct.
To. It's a really good scenario here, Linda, for us. And we wish you well in trying to figure out what to do. Let me grab another call here from Tim in Plymouth. Hi, Tim. How are you thinking about this?
Well, I think that what we ended up doing is having a worldwide behavior change on a dime. Everybody went home because that kept us safe, right? And, you know, I'm a gay man, and I listened to Anthony Fauci back in the 80s with the last HIV pandemic. And those of us who followed his coaching are still alive today. And so I've recognized that it's specific behavior changes that we need to look at. Everybody can look at the CDC website, but how do you translate that? So we're actually launching a social venture called 3C, which is the Consumer Confidence Certification. So any building that isn't currently monitored by public health could that means they're committed to world-class disease prevention best practices.
Let me do this, and Tim. I want to ask Dr. Bostrom, before you get too deep into this, I want to ask Dr. Bostrom for what you initially said, and then we'll go to this idea of kind of seals of approval because it fits into this discussion. But Dr. Bostrom, is what Tim said about, you know, we had to change our behavior instantly, and we're in the midst of this social experiment on behavior and risk.
Yes, that's exactly what's going on. And what we've seen is really reassuring that a lot of people have taken the advice that Dr. Fauci and others have given them to heart and are taking precautions. So they're trying to social distance, they're wearing masks, they're washing their hands frequently, and they're trying to avoid exposures to people, as Dr. Miller said, whose exposures they don't know in turn, so they don't know. There are lots of problematic parts of this, though, because our behaviors are responsive to what we can see, and asymptomatic transmission means that we can't always tell what's going on.
And what do you think, Dr. Bostrom, of this idea that Tim is talking about, and I've been reading about this, where to allay concern, and also, I guess, to observe and reward sanitation efforts, that we may be heading into a time where we look as consumers for these seals of approval, and it tells us something about how we're going to calibrate our own risk. Do you think that's meaningful, I guess?
In theory, it's meaningful. In practice, the little bit I've seen about this from, for example, the National Academies, quick studies and that kind of thing, is that we don't yet have enough information to know how important that's going to be in reducing our risk. So clearly sanitation is important. There is some fomite, there is some risk of transmission from touching surfaces, but aerosolization or breathing seems to be much more important. And that then depends on whether or not the people you are breathing around or have been exposed or are a source of exposure for you. And we don't have a good way of telling right now how well we've controlled our own exposures and how well other people have controlled their exposures. So certifying that's going to be really hard at this point.
Dr. Miller, I was reading about a study this morning that says that by doing the social distancing and the other measures that we took, we have prevented, this research study says, we have prevented 60 million infections by April. And I thought that's, you know, it's hard to verify a negative. I understand all the scientific modeling, but I don't know how meaningful that is for people who are not scientists. You know, you're kind of saying, had we not done this, this would have happened. I wonder how influential that is into people's assessment of their own behavior and the risk. Do you have a thought on that?
I do, actually. It's pretty interesting. If you go back to March and you look, say, on Twitter, there's actually a pretty large community of epidemiologists on Twitter. And the chatter back then was about how if we're right and we convince people to do social distancing at a high level, people are going to come back to us and say, oh, we didn't need to do that. Look, nothing happened.
Right.
And we were like, we're okay with that. Because essentially we could predict as best we could a pretty significant number of cases. And we do anticipate that a lot of lives were saved and a lot of cases were prevented. I don't think that those kinds of studies necessarily help on an individual basis for people to be making decisions. I do think that those kinds of studies help the policymaker level to reinforce that there are times when you have to take drastic measures like we're taking. I think the challenge now for people is really one of risk communication. Because the community is opening up, and if you're not really paying very close attention and you see the community opening up, then you're going to assume that things are okay and you can go back to normal. And I know that simply from the questions that my own family members are asking me at this point in time.
Dr. Bill Miller is with us. He's an epidemiologist at Ohio State's College of Public Health from Columbus, Ohio. And Dr. Ann Bostrom is with us. She's a professor in environmental policy at the Public Policy School and Governance at the University of Washington, where she studies risk perception, communication, and management. Dr. Bostrom, I'm going to get to this idea of communication. We have a caller, I think, who wants to talk about that, to David in Minnetonka. David, risk yes. communication?
Yes, hello.
Hi, glad you called.
Yeah, I'm an industrial hygienist. I also have a degree in public health.
Okay.
And, I do risk communication for a living. Mm-hmm. And something that's important for the risk communicators to remember, and I'm sure that the guests know this wonderfully well, is that technical people think differently than normal people. All right? Simply put, what we don't know bothers us terribly because we don't know. This is the technical side.
Uh-huh.
And what we do know, well, it might not be good news. It might be really, really bad news, but we kind of feel grounded because we know, and we therefore know what to do next.
That makes a lot of sense.
You know, it where does. Normal people, what you don't know ain't going to hurt you, and what you do know scares the living daylights out of you.
Yeah.
And so it really is about, and it's up to the technical people, on how to bridge that gap. All right. I think whoever's coaching Governor Walz is doing a wonderful job breaking down the technical into the non-technical language. But it does come back around to folks realizing that there's three pieces of risk here. There's the health risk, there's the economic risk, and there's the mental health risk.
Mm-hmm.
And as we relax things, from a health point of view, from managing the COVID-19 disease, we're trying things. We're seeing how it goes. And the reason we're doing it is we are yielding to the economic and the mental health imperatives. But in my family, too, I get the question, you know, how about if I go get a haircut? How about if we get that carpet redone and the wallpaper fixed? And the answer always is, how badly do we not want to get sick? And probably in our case, because my wife and I both have elderly parents, how badly do we not want to infect other people?
Yeah. So David,
and that's really the question. How badly do you not want the negative outcome?
Hang with me if you can.
Yes,
Dr. Bostrom, what do you think?
Well, that's very well put. And she obviously has worked with this a lot. There are other kinds of risks that people are considering now, too. And for example, political risks and risks to our social infrastructure, so to speak. Because that staying at home has in these times in particular, huge political and social consequences as well. But what he says is absolutely right, that people pay a lot of attention to what they do know. And for that reason, it's extremely important for risk communicators to talk about what we do know about protecting ourselves and what we do know about the risks that we face if we don't protect ourselves.
Dr. Miller, a tweet here, and this is to what David and Anne have been saying. A listener says, when COVID returns in the fall, Americans will reject renewed lockdown. And next spring, a report will say 60 million cases could have been avoided if we had. And then he cites a Washington Post article on this. Is that a concern, too, that we've had this experience of retreating and opening? And our tolerance, I mean, with all the things that David suggested, right, all these different interests and possibilities that we're trying to assess, our tolerance for risk has also increased in that time.
Well, I think the potential for a substantial second wave is real and concerning. The fall is obviously a time where that may occur. It's really difficult to predict how everyone is going to react to that. And I think part of that is because some parts of the country have been less affected and others have been more affected. And I think if you visit or talk to people, for example, in New York City, I don't think that they would hesitate for very long to resume pretty protective activities because of what they experienced this time.
Right.
But if you go to a place where it's been, you know, I'll give you rural Ohio as an example, you know, it didn't reach rural Ohio.
Dr. Miller, I think we lost your line. We'll try to reconnect there. So, David, what ended up happening with the wallpaper and the carpeting?
Ain't happened yet.
It hasn't happened yet.
No. But, I mean, one of the things you're talking about here is the whiplash. You know, that we say one thing, we say another thing, we say one thing, we say another thing. There was an op-ed early on, I don't remember if it was in the Times or the Wall Street Journal, about all the mixed messages that we're giving.
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, when we talk about the second wave, it's important that folks understand that we're going off of patterns of influenza, especially the 1918-1919-1920 pandemic, and it's all we got. We are doing our best. And it may turn out that way, and it may turn out differently. And the epidemiologists and the public health professionals, all they're doing is they're doing their best.
Dr. Miller, is that right?
That is right. Actually, to be honest, one of my least favorite questions that I get asked all the time is, what's going to happen?
I understand why.
And the reason for that is that every model we make makes assumptions. We use everything that we have at our disposal to make the best models that we can. And that does include information from even back in the 1918-1919 influenza epidemic, but we've had other epidemics since then that provide guidance. And there's also just basic fundamental infectious diseases transmission, epidemiology, knowledge that goes into these predictions. And we know that immunity is important. And consequently, if you don't have high levels of immunity, the risk for rebound is important also. So taking all of those things together, you know, we do the best we can. And some things, you know, we're sure of, like we were very sure that things were going to get bad here in the U.S. and they did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would argue that even with our measures, things haven't been some of the East Asian countries that shut things down and controlled it very tightly.
Dr. Bill Miller with us, epidemiologist at Ohio State's College of Public Health, and Anne Bostrom with us. She's a professor in environmental policy at the School of Public Policy and Governance at the University of Washington. Hey, David, thank you so much for your call. Really good to have it. We're going to get a look at the latest news. When we come back, I've been reading the assessment of some analysts who think and write and study risk, and they're talking about this idea of shaming that's going on. Well, my neighbors are opening up more quickly than I am, and so I'm going to shoot a picture of them and put that on social media, and why that doesn't work either. I want to hear from you about how you're calibrating the risk and whether, as our caller David suggested, some of the mixed messaging that you're getting is really hard to see through, to take in and make the kind of good judgment and assessment that you want to make. Back to our conversation now. Professor Anne Bostrom with us, Dr. Bill Miller with us, and I'm going to go to the phones here to Mara in Hopkins. Is it Mara or Mara?
Mara.
Hi, Mara. Thanks so much for waiting. It sounds like you are trying to figure out risk with a lot of competing situations there. So what are you doing?
Well, I think that my situation is a hyperbolized situation that a lot of parents are going through. That is, I have multiple sclerosis, so I am at a higher, I'm more immune compromised than most.
Right.
And my son has ASD, autism spectrum disorder.
Uh-huh.
So distance learning was not his favorite thing. He struggles with relationships with his peers. And when my husband said, hey, Governor Walz has opened things up for summer camps, do you think we should put Xander back in summer camp so he can have some interaction with other kids? We really had to sit down and think about it because he might bring home something to me that will make me very sick.
But there's a lot of pros, yeah, to him being in camp.
Yeah, he needs that interaction. Yeah.
What'd you decide to do?
Well, he's in camp right now.
Okay.
I think that his mental health is important, and I have a pretty good support system through my neurologist, and my aunt works for the Navy as a captain and a doctor, so hopefully she put me in touch with the most recent ways to treat it if I got it.
Wow. So, Dr. Miller, what do you make of the way Mara and her husband assessed all the, as I suggested, the competing risks here and where they came out?
I think this is another one of those challenging ones. And honestly, there are many challenging circumstances like this. I think if it were my child and I was in the same situation, I would consider things like what the camp activities are, whether they're outside or inside predominantly. If I can, I'd try to figure out where the other children are coming from. Are they coming from a part of the state where there's a lot fewer cases? Or are they coming from parts of the state where there are a lot more? And I would have a plan for I don't know if this is a overnight camp or a day camp. It sounds like it might be a day camp. I would just be cautious and I may even do a symptom check and be checking on my child with a temperature most days so that you could react quickly in case he did become ill.
Mara, I'm sure that occurred to you. Is that part of the plan?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
We have a thermometer by the door. He changes clothes as soon as he gets home.
Yeah.
We have a shower downstairs.
Oh, you're taking...
He plans to quarantine.
Yeah. You're doing a lot of precautionary things.
Yeah.
I hope it works out. It sounds like a tough one. And I'm glad you called, Mara. On Twitter, a listener says, for me, it's about minimizing time spent indoors or in enclosed places with others who are outside my household. My church is opening soon, but I won't be attending. Grocery runs when needed, canceling the gym membership, working out indoors goes against my principles. And to the phones to Mackenzie in Hudson, Wisconsin. Hi, Mackenzie. How are you working this out?
Hi, Carrie. So my family and I, we've taken kind of it's kind of a funny approach. We've decided to Marie Kondo our social distancing method.
Okay, what does that mean in real life?
So basically, like the idea with Marie Kondo, where we hold something, and if it gives us some kind of pleasure or joy or comfort, then it's something that we keep in our lives. So, you know, like Dr. Miller was saying, like doing our best. This is a method that is so simplified, but it is us. We're doing our best. So when we consider the kinds of things that we're going to expose ourselves to, my husband and I and our two boys, we have a nearly one-year-old and a four-year-old. So we really take that into consideration. We you know, like, for example, Grandma wants the four-year-old to come to North Dakota and visit for a week. And she would like to come and pick him up and bring him home by way of airplane.
Ah.
And so we sat with that idea and, you know, kind of metaphorically held it in our hands, and we decided, you know what, that doesn't feel good. That doesn't feel like a good choice, even though we have a healthy little four-year-old boy, and we are all fortunate to be healthy ourselves. It just doesn't feel like a risk that we want to take.
Was it the flying or was it the just having your son go somewhere else and be there for a week with your
It's the flying. It's the flying for us, because where he's going, he would be going. Both of our sets of parents live there, and that, you know, we love to send him to Nana and Grammy's houses, and, you know, that feels great because he's treated like a king for sure.
And I'm sure Grammy's like, why do I have to suffer for that, right? Not seeing my grandkids. Oh, so hard.
That's exactly it. She's frustrated with us, but as we've said, you know, that doesn't feel like a responsible decision for our family to make, and it puts too many people at risk, and that's just not a risk we're willing to take at this point.
I have to say, if I was being denied time with my grandparents, that would be a big deal at that age. Oh my gosh, this is tough. So how are you working it out?
You know, it's something that we've decided, just as a couple, as a partnership, that it's something we're going to stick to. And we've said, you know, what we need to figure out an alternative, because we don't want to deprive them of that time. We're not sure what that alternative will look like at this point, because traveling 10 and a half hours in a car with a one-year-old is not fun. Trying to figure out that happy medium, and something that meets the needs of everybody and keeps us all safe.
Geez, I wish you well, and I'm really glad you called.
Thank you.
It sounds like you guys are still wrestling with this. And I want to ask you about this idea that I suggested about shaming. I was reading something that Julia Marcus, a population medicine expert at Harvard, wrote for The Atlantic on acknowledging that even though testing capacity still isn't where it should be, we are accepting this idea of harm reduction instead of abstinence. And here's what she says. Harm reduction recognizes that some people are going to take risks, whether public health experts want them to or not. And instead of condemnation, offers them strategies to reduce any potential harms. This approach meets people where they are and acknowledges that individual level decisions happen in a broader context, which may include factors that are out of people's control. You've seen the shaming. Does it work?
That actually, I haven't seen the shaming.
You not been on social media? Well, it's all over the place.
I have to admit that I avoid social media, even though I'm a risk communication scholar.
Wise woman,
social media can be very extreme and quite harmful to people's mental health. So it's, the shaming, I'm not surprised, though, because it's something that you see actually even in other public health circumstances. Shaming, for example, has been considered a way of trying to get like restaurants to use better sanitation practices and that kind of thing by putting grades on them. It's the same kind of thing, and you risk the same kind of reaction that people will react to the shaming with a very negative response. So we might be polarizing the situation if you use that kind of an approach. So there is some evidence that this kind of approach at least theoretically works, but it seems to me like it's very socially risky.
Yeah, you know, Bill, it's interesting because social pressure seemed to work, and maybe it's still working in some cases with masking and that kind of thing. But when it tips, I mean, there's like a spectrum of it where it's effective. When it seems to tip over into the shaming, it seems to be less effective. I wonder if you have some thoughts on just where to really get that right.
Well, I think, to me, one of the things that is a little bit underemphasized in all of this is that when you're protecting yourself, you're also protecting other people. And it's not simply a function of will I get sick or not. It's also a function of if I get sick, will I infect other people around me that I care about? Or even, frankly, people that I don't care about. Because we know that many cases are asymptomatic and can still transmit. We know that many cases may be relatively mild and still transmit. So it's not simply a function of people sort of thinking about, oh, will I get sick or not? It should also be a function of, I want to protect other people. And shaming, you know, I generally agree with the article. I don't think shaming works very well. One of my big research areas historically is sexually transmitted infections, and it's very clear that approaches to that kind of infection, shaming is just completely stigmatizing and harmful.
I mean, because partly, isn't it because initially the warnings were about abstinence, and that just, right. Doesn't the research show us that just did not work?
Right. And that's sort of a simple biological function.
Dr. Miller, good to have you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Bill Miller is an epidemiologist at Ohio State's College of Public Health. Dr. Bostrom, thank you to you. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
And Dr. Ann Bostrom is a professor in environmental policy at the School of Public Policy and Governance at the University of Washington in Seattle.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for listening.